from a wide audience. I think we've got people from elsewhere, including Oxford and people who've travelled some distance, so thank you very much for coming. Also, I think we have some people from the Central Asian Forum. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah,
so Central Asian Forum.
Excellent. And we've also got plenty of people from within the faculty, so we've got staff, PhD students, masters, which is fantastic to see such a wide group. Because we tend to hide over in Trumpeton House, and some of you may not be familiar with David, although most of the staff are, because your reputation precedes you as somebody who knows an incredible amount about international education, higher education, schools, you name it, David will know something that is of pertinent and of great use to anybody working in education. So that's all I really want to say is that David Bridges will take us through. He is the Director of Research with regards to the Kazakhstan project, which several of us are working on, including myself, Natalia, and Elena, who you'll be hearing from later. We also have colleagues who are joining us via Skype, and they've co-authored some of the papers that you'll see set out before you. We've got Kairat Karakbeyev. Hopefully I pronounced that correctly. He will be joining us by Skype. Unfortunately, Asel cannot be joining us, but she sent something which Natalia, my colleague, will read out to provide her input as well. So it's very much a collegiate type of thing, but David is our leader, so there are refreshments that he can take you through, so I shall quickly hand you over to David because I'm taking up important time when he could be telling you about what it is that he knows.
Okay. Right. Okay. Thank you, Liz, and thank you, everybody, for coming. We're keen to leave plenty of time, not just for questions at the end, but also for you to contribute from your experience. And I should emphasize, I don't apologize for this, that this is very much work in... Oh, God, sorry. there's no hiding from these things. No. This is very much work in progress. And in fact, my presentation and Alina's are part of a symposium that we're beginning to prepare for the European Conference on Educational Research in Istanbul next September. So we've got a bit of time to write those, and this is a kind of early excursion into the territory, and so we very much welcome any contributions you make. I hope we can, you know, sometimes in this series of seminars, we'll be having great authorities to report on very much finished work. But we also want to use the seminars to give people the chance to try out ideas or maybe beginnings of research that they're doing. And that applies to doctoral students and master's students as well. So if you're yourself doing some research in this area about education reform in Central Asia, in sort of post-Soviet economies and so on, and would like to try it out with the group at some stage, please let us know. Alina takes responsibility for organising the seminars. We're very happy to provide a forum for discussion of work in progress, as well as finished papers. And you will see that mine is very much work in progress. It sort of tails off a bit towards the end. Somebody's dancing.
Sorry about that.
No, don't worry. The work which, this is a collaborative research project between ourselves here in Cambridge and Nazarbayev University, in particular the Center for Education Policy at Nazarbayev University. It's part of a wider partnership we have with a new Graduate School of Education at Nazarbayev University, and it's partly a contribution to research capacity building there. My own view is the best way to learn research is to do it and to work at it rather than just sit in training workshops all the time. But of course, we rely very heavily on the internal knowledge of people like Kairat and Asel, who are working with me on this particular paper. We're coming very much as outsiders. We have two kinds of outsider on the project. We have the real outsiders, like me, the kind of the English, and we have the kind of semi-outsiders like Alina and Natalia, who have their experience under the Soviet regime. Both were educated in Belarus and Ukraine, respectively, in the Soviet era, and have seen it through into post-independence in countries which are addressing many of the same sort of issues that Kazakhstan is addressing. So they're kind of semi-outsiders, and some of us are complete outsiders, but Kairat and Asel and the other colleagues in CEP join with us very much as insiders to the education reform process in Kazakhstan. So we're trying to make sense of education reform. We're looking at different dimensions of it. In the first year, last year, we focused very much on the policy level. What were the drivers of policy? What from the perspectives of people at the center, in the ministry, in the Quango, which is called Nazarbayev Intellectual Schools, which is leading part of the reform process, what at the top level were the understandings of and perspectives on what was happening in education reform? And we have a set of papers, and if any of you are interested, we're very happy to let you have a copy of those papers, which were derived from that first year of the work. And this year, we're kind of turning the whole system upside down. And in about 4 weeks' time, we go off to three regions in Kazakhstan to do case studies of schools and try to understand how the reform process looks if you're a teacher in a school, including some small rural schools and schools out in the provinces, not just in Astana or part of the Nazarbayev Intellectual School system. So we're kind of looking at education reform from both ends. But the thing that interests me, not only me, and a number of my colleagues too, is what you might call the translations of policy. And there are really two aspects to this translation. And you probably can't see that, nor can I actually, but some of you got a printed document, which I can't see either. So I'll have to try and remember what I said here. But this has really got two phases. There's one, and I'll just stick with the language of translation for the moment. I want to kind of re-examine that later. There's one translation, which is from international policy. Whoops. Oh, it's one of these clever boards. I don't know how to deal with that. There we go. It's from international policy and practice, because Kazakhstan, like a lot of other countries in the region, is looking to direct its reform strategy by reference to whatever is seen as best practice internationally. That, of course, combined with elements of local culture, tradition, and practice. So there's the translation of international policy and practice into a package of education reforms adopted and for implementation locally. And this is the territory which is sometimes referred to as policy borrowing, sometimes policy cherry picking, because people just pick bits out of international practice. And of course, although I refer to international policy and practice, all these terms really need to be inverted commas. You know, what is international policy and practice? It's always interpreted, it's always selected, it's not something which is very clearly demarcated. So there is a process by which, through people like ourselves sometimes, international policy and practice then gets translated into some sort of package of education reform designed at the centre, at the ministry or through whatever agency the centre chooses to do that. But the process doesn't stop there, because from the centre it has to be communicated to the schools. So you've got another process, which Elaine Wilson here has been very centrally involved in through a structure in Kazakhstan called Centres of Excellence, of, in this case, training trainers to train teachers to implement changes in pedagogy and assessment in their classrooms. So you've got a double process of translation. And this notion of translation is the, really the sort of central concept I want to play with a bit and examine. And notice certain features of what's going on here. Notice, first of all, that there is a huge distance between that and that, between what happened, whatever it is which people are referring to and identifying as international policy and practice, and what may or may not end up in the classroom somewhere on the outskirts of Shymkent or Aktau or Povlodar, which are the three places we're going to visit in a few weeks' time. That is a huge social distance. Notice, secondly, at how many stages there is not merely the possibility of interpretation, but an absolute requirement for interpretation and selection. For example, I mean, even deciding, you know, what are these international policies and practices which it may or may not be worth borrowing? Somebody's got to actually identify them. Somebody's got to choose from an array. And when we talk about international, the policy leaders in Kazakhstan are referring to the UK, they're referring to the United States, they're travelling. Puyash, who's one of the leaders of this process, is down the corridor at the moment. She's just come from Finland. They went to Estonia because Estonia is supposed to be very good at trilingual practice. They refer to Singapore, this small state which has been very dynamic and very successful. They refer to Hong Kong, they refer to Japan, to Korea. You know, so what is this international policy and practice? What we know is there are certain kind of notions that start to occupy what's sometimes called the global education space. Certain things like outcomes-based education, active learning, student-based education, student-focused assessment for learning, and so on. You get these certain kind of regularities, but even all those have to be interpreted and reinterpreted, and what sense you make of them changes in different places and at different times. So at each stage, in developing a national program, there always has to be reference to what is judged best in existing practice. And I think we've become increasingly aware of the successes of the former Soviet system, and Alina will say a bit more about that in due course, in things like achieving high rates of literacy, high participation in higher education, pretty equal educational achievement between males and females, strong performance on certain kinds of tests in subjects like mathematics. You know, it's not without its own successes. But even to decide what are the good bits you want to hang on to is a judgment that somebody has to make. And then the international and what's viewed as valuable in national practice and experience have somehow to be brought together. And in countries like Kazakhstan, I'm also involved in Mongolia, there's a very strong sense of wanting to protect and maintain local culture and not just get local culture obliterated by this internationalisation programme. This became the focus in Mongolia of last June's election, a huge debate about whether the previous government was subordinating local culture to this sort of international culture led by Cambridge University, of course, which was we became very much implicated in the arguments, and we're just resurfacing from those. So interpretation, and down here too, UK, you get a national policy programme, but all that has to be translated before it actually reaches schools. You have to have people working on the curriculum and on the syllabuses. You've probably got a different lot of people working on textbooks for schools. You've probably got a different lot of people working on the exam system and assessment. You've got a different lot of people working on teacher training. So across all these channels of communication, you're getting different interpretations going on, so that what comes out at the end here, in terms of what's transmitted to schools, to principals, and perhaps, or to local authorities, and to schools, and to principals, all that has gone through quite a process of reinterpretation, of translation, or whatever you want to call it. So there's a process of translation from the international to the national. There's a process of translation from whatever is agreed at the centre nationally to implementation in schools. And it's these, what happens in these processes, which is part of what interests us in the research. And we haven't got to grips with that. Come back next year, we may be able to give you a bit more empirically based data about that. But those are the issues. But in the meantime, I start to get, so those are really the main points of what I want to make. That it's not surprising, therefore, that whatever is identified at the beginning, either between international practice and national policy, or whatever gets translated from national policy into practice in schools, goes through all sorts of reinterpretations and changes. We shouldn't be surprised at that. Now, part of what I find interesting is the issue of kind of finding a language to describe this process. I've adopted the process of translation, partly because I think translation, and this is where I need to go further than I've gone so far into translation theory. Translation inevitably involves interpretation and reinterpretation. Translation isn't a mechanical process of substituting one word for another. You're trying to get at meaning, and in the process of translation, you're always bringing your own understandings and maybe a whole set of cultural understandings to that process. Some of you who are now dealing with educational issues in your second, third, or fourth language may be able to provide some interesting examples of that process. In talking with colleagues in Kazakhstan, and I can't remember the Russian word, maybe Kyra can remind me, the preference seemed to be for the language of transmission. How does transmission translate into Russian? Transmission. What is it? Okay, all right. Now, I don't know whether it conveys the same things in Russian, but we would not feel very comfortable with the notion of transmission as a description of a form of pedagogy in this country. It supposes that somehow the teacher has got the precise knowledge, and the job is simply for the learner to reproduce that knowledge in the same form that the teacher gives it. So a transmission model of teaching is not, on the whole, regarded with great favour. So but you see how these different terms carry different kind of resonances. At least they do in English. One of the struggles is, of course, knowing what resonances this different language carries once it gets translated not only into Russian but also into Kazakh, which is a whole extra unknown territory for us. We have Russian speakers in the team, but our Kazakh speakers are in with CEP. So there are interesting issues about even how you describe this process. There are also part of the discourse the training of trainers that we're doing, colleagues here are doing through the Centres of Excellence, is what we would have referred to in the past as a cascade model, where you train trainers who train either train teachers or train further trainers who train teachers, and you kind of take the messages from the centre to periphery. And I mean, I think all the studies that have been done in the past about the cascade model of training acknowledge there are always issues of the meaning getting lost or changed as it passes from one person to another. I mean, the team here have built in a kind of support system with mentors for the trainers to try and, as it were, avoid that particular problem. But inevitably, if I'm telling you something and you tell somebody else, and they then go on and tell somebody else, by the time it comes out in the end, it's like the children's game of Chinese whispers. There are always issues in that, and we need to understand that. But maybe this isn't always something to be regretted, and I'll come to that towards the end. So there are all sorts of things which shape this process of translation and interpretation. You know, there are some things that people simply do not understand. They've not got the right conceptual apparatus. And I think one of the things which our experience in this program is reminding us that in the UK, for example, and in other parts of the Western world, we can talk freely about notions like reflective practice or classroom action research. But behind those, or school self-evaluation, but behind those is a whole history of development and ideas about extended professionalism of teachers and of teachers taking more responsibility for their own learning, which may not be part of the experience in a country like Kazakhstan. So these ideas, you can't just sort of grasp them in isolation from a network of other ideas. And then we will illustrate shortly some of the misunderstandings. In some ways, misunderstandings are more problematic than not understanding. If somebody says, "I don't understand," then you know you've got something to deal with. But if they think they've understood, but not understood, but misunderstood, then you've got something more complex to untangle. People bring different underlying assumptions, bring different values, both at the national policy level and at the micro level of the classroom. All teachers have convictions about what works within their own classrooms. And on the whole, they're not easily going to be budged from what they think works, though there are also issues about what counts as working. If in any context where you're asking teachers to learn to do things differently, you're effectively de-skilling them. And they're having to learn new skills, and they may either have difficulty in learning those skills or just lack confidence in acquiring new skills. Or maybe they just don't have the motivation. If you've been teaching 30 years and you think you know how to do the job and the children seem pretty satisfied and you're getting good results, why would you want to change? What motivation is there for doing so, apart from the fact that these people at the centre who clearly have no idea what it's like in a school are telling you you should change? So there are lots of reasons why the messages get changed as we go through the system. And what I find interesting then, because it's very easy to observe, and this isn't just in Kazakhstan. One of the people who was here earlier, just before Christmas, Iveta Silova, has written about these processes with particular reference to Mongolia. Is the different language which is applied to what happens when certain international practices get changed in the process of them being assimilated into new places. And some of the language, you know, is actually drawn from the repertoire of criminal acts or revolutionary acts, the subversion. You get these sort of political criminals who are teachers who are subverting educational change. You get Silova, this isn't Silova's own language, but she refers to people talking about people in particular countries hijacking the educational reform process. You get this nice notion of brand name piracy, where people adopt the name, yes, I'm doing active learning. I remember actually going into a classroom in Taiwan, Tershan, and I couldn't work out what was going on because the teacher was conducting some sort of test, but the children had to keep jumping up out of their desks and going to the front to answer the questions. And then they'd answer the questions, the teacher would test, check whether they got it right, and then they'd run back to their seats. And the teacher explained to me afterwards, this was active learning. He'd taken, or she in this case, had taken a rather literal interpretation of what active learning meant, was you had to be physically moving about while learning. And the idea that active learning might involve, as it were, interactivity of psychological processes had been totally lost. So that would be an example of brand name piracy, especially if that was extended over a whole system. So you get these very negative languages used for this process. And the process is the one by which what comes out at the end of that long chain of dissemination doesn't look very much like what went in at the beginning, to put it crudely. But you also get these more positive versions to describe it. Indigenization, or in the case of Silova's work on Mongolia, Mongolization. Now, in our work with Mongolia, the ministry is absolutely clear. They're interested in looking at, for example, what Cambridge International Examinations can offer in terms of curriculum or assessment, but they're going to make it Mongolian. And they will change it, and it will incorporate aspects of Mongolian culture. And in our own language, the last ones are drawn from things that have been said in the context of Cambridge's work. You know, we're saying we need to respect national culture and tradition. So what comes out at the end shouldn't look exactly like what Cambridge Assessment or Cambridge Faculty of Education are doing anywhere else. It should be changed to reflect aspects of national culture and tradition. And we talk about the importance of giving the communities we're working with ownership of the change. Well, if they have ownership, they have the right to modify and change it. So, you know, there is a different kind of rhetoric and a different kind of discourse which can surround these changes which take place in the process of translation, in contrast to some of these more negative forms of language. And I want to eventually kind of tease all that out a bit more. Just finally, because I haven't got far into this, I think there are sources, and the colleagues here know more about some of these than I do. I mean, I went back to Piaget, who I hadn't read for many years. I've forgotten how difficult Piaget is, actually. And Piaget's notion of learning in terms of assimilation and accommodation. And of course, when we learn something, certain elements of two things happen. To some extent, our own conceptual frameworks are changed to accommodate the new stuff. We have to kind of, if we see our first black swan, we have to revise our previous assumption that all swans are white. Okay, so we have to accommodate this new information. An alternative possibility is we change what we see in some way. If we're really resistant to the idea of black swans, we might say, well, what I saw wasn't really a black swan, it was a black something else. Maybe it was a sort of goose or something like that. So so that's more, as it were, changing what we incorporate so that it fits better. But these processes of how we manage new knowledge, I think are well documented and well described in cognitive psychology, and it shouldn't surprise us that these are going on in these processes of translation of policy and practice. And, you know, the very fashionable, these days everybody seems to talk the talk anyway of constructivist psychology, and in which we would acknowledge that meaning always is co-constructed, and that's part of what underpins the whole kind of student-centered learning. We need to acknowledge what students are bringing to learning, and what they learn is new meanings constructed between what they bring and the new experiences that they encounter. And Alina, when shortly, and I must finish, is in a sense pursuing that line in some of her work, because what we've become very clearly conscious of is the importance of the Soviet and post-Soviet inheritance, which teachers in Kazakhstan are bringing to new ideas. And finally, translation theory, and I'm hoping Asel and Kairat are going to help with this. There's a sense we're dealing here partly with translation as a metaphor for what happens in the processes by which ideas are brought from the center to the periphery. But of course, we're also facing translation issues in a much more literal sense. And I just want to conclude with an example. Asel is not able to join us, but she gave an example, which I'll ask Natalia to read out, of just one case. And I'm sure people like Elaine and Morag, who've been doing the training, can find many more examples where the language itself has been a barrier to this understanding. So maybe you could read what Asel has sent us.
In the process of translating information about the graduate school of education into Kazakh and Russian languages that was to be placed in the website, we faced a difficulty in translating the term like school leadership. In fact, we do not have the concept of leadership in educational system. We do not use this term in the context of education. In our control system of secondary and higher education, we use such terms like administration, management. In Russian, it's administrirование, управление. In Kazakh, it's Vaskaru, Akimshinek, Etomshinek.
Do we need a Kazakh interpreter?
But we do not convey the meaning of leadership that is used to be in the context of British and American education. As far as I know, the term school leadership came into the currency into the later 20th century for the several reasons. Demands were made on the school for higher levels of pupils' achievement, and schools were expected to improve and reform. Administration and management are terms that that convey stability through the exercise of control and supervision. The concept of leadership was favored because it conveys dynamics and proactivity. The principal or school head is commonly thought to be the school leader. However, school leadership may include other persons, such as members of formal leadership team and other persons who contribute towards the aims of the school. The direct translation of leadership sounds like koshbashilik in Kazakh, like leaderstva in Russian. But they do not convey the meaning that is embodied in the term leadership in the context of education. The same case is with translation of lesson study. term that is often used in the context of secondary education now and causes some difficulties in its translation. In fact, the direct translation of this term will be adequately understood. In Kazakh and Russian languages, we have such a concept as lesson analysis that is closest in meaning to this term. The Kazakh translation is Sabakti Taltau. Thank you. In Russian, it sounds like analiz uroka, but it will be correct to use this translation. And how properly we will convey the meaning of lesson study. So this is
okay,
on thanks. Behalf of ourselves.
So that's just a couple of examples, and you may want to contribute others of where the language really does works against you in terms of translating ideas. Okay, I think that's as much as I want to say, probably too much. And
perhaps we can ask Kairat whether he has any contributions
okay.
to this particular paper.
Kairat, are
you
still there?
Would you like to contribute now or after my presentation?
It would be more relevant to David's presentation.
Okay, we can hear you very well now, so you can continue.
Go ahead, Kyra.
Yes, to be more relevant to David's presentation, I would like to say some comments right now.
Yes, please.
Yes. Okay. And then returning back to wise words of Abai, and not Abai his time said that we deserve to be representatives of so many cultures that you have mastered the languages of these cultures. So also, I think also in the spirit of changing conceptual frameworks and assimilation accommodation. As long as you master the terms, then you are kind of entitled to be in this area of using the terms and the life approaches. And Asel has sent you some terms, and I also have some terms as examples. And for example, we have the term cognitive, which is also has been transliterated into just cognitivne or cognitiv in Kazakh. But for the Kazakh ears, for the Kazakh speakers, it will be more equivalent to translate it into a proper Kazakh term, which is tanandyk. And this is more typical, more acceptable for the Kazakh ear. And then, David was also categorizing the terms into some. He has given some categories of translation issues, and we have and the terms that we have come up with. They all fit into one of them. For example, if you talk about action research, then still many teachers and policymakers still grapple and experience some difficulties with. Coming up with the proper equivalent of this term. And some people just end up with transliterating the concept, and some people just end up with literal translation. And another one is also the critical trend, which is also a kind of very new concept. I'm not sure if it's a traditional one in teaching methodology in the UK context. But if you go and translate into give a literal translation, then still not comprehensible. It's not still doesn't give convey the proper meaning of what you mean by saying critical friend. And if you give the translation in Kazakh or Russian. So these examples they mean that in this case that translating the word does not provide sufficient understanding of what it's all about. It's the category three. If you try to classify them again, the classification that they use. All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you
very
much.
I suggest Elaine, do you want to come up?
having been almost a year now doing this work, working with teachers on the ground in Kazakhstan, this business of translation has caused us enormous problems. And we have tried to overcome that by working closely with both Russian and Kazakh speakers to try and come to a common understanding. And indeed, we have left lesson study in the anglicised form.
Right.
And indeed, they haven't translated that. And that seems to cause, I think there's quite a good familiarity that it originated in Japan. And but we've also produced a glossary where we have talked and worked with teachers and experts on the ground so that we come from a common understanding of some of these problematic ideas. So I think we've made some headway, but I'm not saying we have completely solved the problem.
Yeah.
But it certainly was our biggest problem at the beginning of the project.
Yes.
Could I add something to that? Too? One of the things that I noticed with working with teachers is sometimes any language was impoverished because we were talking about big conceptual ideas. And one of the things that we noticed was that there was a real drive often to actually present something as a picture or as an illustration. So rather than actually have an idea or a summary of ideas expressed in words, the words would be, added to that would be an illustration, a picture, some kind of motive or object that would encapsulate the idea. And I found that really interesting. And I, listening to David, it occurred to me that part of the reason for that was probably because not only was the language contested, but also it was impoverished in terms of trying to encapsulate a big idea into a word.
Although I think the Kazakhs like to use metaphors.
That's one of the things that you said earlier about this.
Yeah.
I don't know whether our colleagues from Kazakhstan would recognize that, but you enjoy using metaphors to describe things or speak about things. Or natural poets, really.
Yeah. Like Irish, very similar to Irish.
And perhaps if any of you have more examples, we can then talk to in the end of the session if we press on with the presentation.